From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, how is Hollywood portraying climate change, and can the industry offer solutions? Then, a documentary filmmaker turns the camera on her deaf son as he learns to play Moonlight Sonata.
My son, at 11 years old, wanted to learn a piece that was composed by arguably the most famous deaf person who ever lived, Beethoven, as he was coming to the realization and acceptance that he himself was going deaf.
And in the new film, The Sound of Silence, Peter Sarsgaard plays a sonic therapist. We'll learn what the heck that means from the film's director. All that coming up on The Frame. Today, KPCC is wrapping up its part in a global week-long media initiative called Covering Climate Now. There's no question climate change is real, even if one in 10 Americans doesn't yet believe that. So what role can Hollywood play addressing climate change and offering potential solutions? With us now is Elaine Lowe. She's a reporter with Variety who recently wrote about this topic. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
So it doesn't feel like climate change is a neglected topic in Hollywood. From documentaries to docuseries to narrative stories, can you talk about some of the most recent examples?
We've seen climate change touched on, I think, more indirectly than directly in ways you may not even think about. Like, for example, the last Avengers movie or the second to last Avengers movie, Avengers Infinity War. People don't think of that as a climate change movie, but Thanos wipes out half of the population, sort of an eco-terrorist move to try to wipe out half the population in an effort to save the health of the universe. So we see it trickle in ways like that, less so in direct ways. I think the last time we saw a more direct addressing of climate change is, you have movies like The Day After Tomorrow, which was all the way back from 2004, or An Inconvenient Truth, which was, not fictional and probably, I think, the only time we've ever seen climate change addressed in a nonfiction way that has really brought audiences to theaters.
Well, there's also a very popular streaming series called Our Planet that is up for a primetime Emmy. Let's listen to a little bit from Our Planet.
All across our planet, crucial connections are being disrupted. The stability that we and all life relies upon is being lost. What we do in the next 20 years will determine the future for all life on Earth.
There is a quote attributed to Samuel Goldwyn, but it actually comes from the playwright Moss Hart, which is, if you have a message, call Western Union. It feels like documentaries are pretty much on the nose about what climate change means, whereas narrative films are trying to figure out how to incorporate that message. Is that something that Hollywood is struggling with now because it doesn't probably want to make narrative films that feel too preachy?
I think there's certainly an element to wanting to go to the theater and be thrilled, right? And are you going to be thrilled by listening to a lecture on the climate crisis, or are you going to be thrilled by seeing a 50-foot tsunami overtake Santa Monica Beach? And I think that's kind of where you see more disaster movies at the box office and more nonfiction documentaries on the smaller screen or on shows like Our Planet. You know, I think there's an element there of perhaps wanting to see what will actually resonate with viewers at the box office. And you know, if some people don't necessarily believe in the climate crisis at all, I think there's a risk of dividing your audience there.
So it feels like narrative films and documentaries can point out how real climate change is. But what about solutions? And let's start first with what Hollywood is doing. Are you starting to see some green practices on sets or in production companies? What is the town itself doing?
Sure. There are a lot of different ways that the industry is trying to combat the climate crisis. There are efforts on the corporation level, and there are also efforts on a production level. I was talking to Michelle King, one of the co-creators of Evil. She and Robert King also created The Good Wife and The Good Fight. And on their set, they have one production assistant that's dedicated exclusively to eco training and will make sure that things are composted and that biodegradable utensils are used, and that when all is said and done and the set is wrapped, that they will donate any decorations and furniture that they have left over to organizations like Habitat for Humanity in an effort to reuse those things. So there's definitely an effort in pockets of the community, and I think it's more just about seeing more institutional change at this point.
Is it fair to say that network television is maybe taking a little bit more of an aggressive approach right now?
Programming-wise, sure. You look at Our Planet on Netflix, where you have a walrus throwing itself off of a cliff. I mean, 5-10 years ago, would you have had David Attenborough narrating a scene like that? About this walrus trying to fight for its own survival because of the terrible impacts of the climate crisis. You also have shows like, A Climate Reckoning in the Heartland, which is a CBSN original. It's a documentary on the impact of climate change on farming in Nebraska. You have Leonardo DiCaprio's documentary on HBO this year, Ice on Fire, trying to find, never before seen solutions to the climate crisis. So I think on TV in particular, more so than on the big screen, you're seeing an effort there to document this crisis, to show people really the ramifications of our behavior as a society and how we're impacting the world around us.
Let me ask you this last question. There's obviously a moral argument to addressing climate change, and there's been a lot of debate about the financial argument about addressing climate change. In terms of how Hollywood sees it, how are they figuring out why it is good business to go green?
Well, when I was talking to Michelle King on Evil and the chief procurement officer at CBS, I was asking, is there a financial disincentive to go green? And he said, maybe 10 years ago that would have been the case, but we've found now that we can actually go green and make that financially beneficial for us and actually potentially save money in some areas. So it's not necessarily an effort that, winds up emptying Hollywood's pockets, but going green and making money can go hand in hand.
Elaine Lowe is a reporter at Variety. Elaine, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, John.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me.
That conversation was part of Covering Climate Now. You can keep up with all the entertainment industry news at Variety.com. Coming up next on The Frame, a documentary filmmaker makes a movie about her son's losing his hearing, but does she see him as the subject of her film or her child? In 2007, documentary filmmaker Irene Taylor Brodsky released her first memoir movie. It was called Here and Now, that's H-E-A-R, and it focused on her parents, who are both deaf. Her latest project centers on her son, Jonas, who began to lose his hearing as a baby. Here's 11-year-old Jonas talking about his cochlear implants.
I'm deaf. The implants just help me hear, but without the implants, I'd be deaf, and the implants are a part of me.
Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, follows young Jonas as he undertakes one of classical music's toughest pieces, both with and without the aid of his hearing aid. Brodsky told me that when Jonas started losing his hearing as an infant, she planned to make a film about him, but scrapped the idea, only to return to it 11 years later.
As odd as this sounds, I don't think my son's life as a deaf kid in and of itself is compelling enough to make a film. I actually think it was the confluence of extraordinary historical poetry, if you will, that really made this film worth making. My son, at 11 years old, wanted to learn a piece that was composed by arguably the most famous deaf person who ever lived, Beethoven, as he was coming to the realization and acceptance that he himself was going deaf.
And in many ways, your son sees, and I will say hears, the world in a different way when it's off. I mean, I think one of the most profound things about your son is the way that he receives information when he doesn't hear information. It's different. It's not better or worse, but it in some ways is more meaningful to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, living in 2019, with a lot of the technology we have more and more biomedical technology that can go inside of our bodies and have a profound impact on our senses, right? But I think that with the asset of those technologies, with the asset of all the accessibility available by law to deaf people in our country, certainly not around the world yet, but in our country, I think it frees us up a little bit to talk more honestly and more hopefully about the contributions of a disabled affect that one may have, or a differently abled way of living. Because the truth is, Jonas has many fewer barriers than my parents had when they were going to school in the 50s.
I think every documentary filmmaker who is honest will say sometimes the best things for a movie are the hardest things to watch as a director. And I'll play a scene with your father that involves his failing to remember his ATM code.
I'm not sure if the passcode will work.
He's on his computer and he can't remember his code. And it's obviously great for the movie, but as a child of him, it's got to be hard to watch and hard to film. Do you remember that day and the conversations you had with your dad about filming that?
Yeah, it was definitely not planned that I would be filming my father as much as I did, but his dementia just started creeping into our lives and we were filming our lives. So his dementia started to creep into our film. And it became a real challenge in the edit room to sort of elegantly weave that into the story. And filming Dad was definitely the hardest. I think filming my dad, and maybe when Jonas was really young, filming around the time of his surgery was also hard. But those were mostly iPhone movies. I didn't have like a big HBO crew with me around that time. But I'm a documentarian, so naturally I would pick up the camera and just quickly cover some of the major plot points, not of a film that I necessarily saw, but of a narrative that was developing. And I see everything in narrative terms, so.
But all of this is happening inside of a family, and there are other people in the family. And I can't imagine how they are affected by what it is you're observing and what it is you're focusing your attention on. So how do you have a family conversation about your work and about how you're looking at certain members of the family and maybe during the day or when you're working and not other people?
My attitude with this particular film was film now, think about it later. That's not the approach I take with every film, but I also had the tremendous good fortune to have mostly unfettered access to my characters. So there were times, sure, when Irene, please, not right now. Don't have the camera right now. But they're really, I mean, I can count them on one hand over a year and a half. It was really more just knowing that you never know when those little moments in your life or in the family's life are going to turn out to be key turning points or key plot points, or they're just going to be the texture that you really need. I think, though, the really difficult moments with my dad, I tell him he cannot drive my children anymore. He tells me that something is wrong with his mind and he doesn't know what it is. He forgets his ATM passcode. These are moments that were excruciating because we all knew, uh-oh. This is an important part of the slope that we're all sliding down right now. So I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. I told my mother that my father couldn't drive my kids anymore. And so my mother texts me while I'm in the studio and I'm working on this film. And she says, Dad's upset. He wants to know why he can't drive your kids anymore. He's been doing this for so long. He's very upset, Irene. Can we come over and talk to you? I said, sure, come on over. And then I thought, I'm sitting here, I'm surrounded by all my cameras, I'm in my studio. So I quickly texted her back 2 minutes later and I said, give Dad a heads up, I'd like to film this. I didn't ask. I just said, give Dad a heads up. Now that maybe makes me sound unlikable, but we had a certain understanding, my family. My parents filmed me all the time. We have so much documentation of us as kids. I've shot 200 hours of footage of them for the previous film, Here and Now. I said, just tell me if that's not okay. And she said, he said, it's fine. So when they came over, I actually filmed them walking in the door. Now that moment doesn't go into the scene, but you just don't know if you're going to need that moment. So you shoot that moment, right? And instead we cut directly to the heart of the conversation.
We're talking with Irene Taylor-Brodsky about her film, Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. It's so funny. About 3 minutes ago, you said your characters.
Mm-hmm.
One of these characters is your son. And when you're looking through the eyepiece or the monitor, are you looking at a character or are you looking at your child?
I'm definitely looking at a character. I'm not sure what that says about me. But I'm looking at a character who I know very well. And I think my blind spot in this case is because you know your character well, you think you know where the story's headed. But there were still many, many surprises. And I think that knowing my character well just made me a little more intuitive about, I think I can turn the camera off now. Because, of course, when you're in your home, the temptation to film him literally as he brushes his teeth and gets himself in bed, it's there every day. And you're worried that that's going to be your opus moment, you know, when he gets into bed and he says something. So some of that is just intuition guiding you. You want to film enough so that you have a lot to choose from, but you don't want to film so much that you overwhelm your subject or your character. Or your son, in this case, because you're trying to be a reasonable person.
I want to play one more clip, and this involves Jonas. Let's listen to this clip.
Jonas, would you like to take off your implants and just check out for a little while? Just something, honey, to just let your senses calm down. I'm always just trying to understand how we can live with this better, because it's hard. And the hardest person it's for right now, it's the hardest for you.
Yeah, not on top of them.
Did you know what Papa said to me today?
What?
He told me he thought his life was better because he was deaf.
How did the making of this film, do you think, change Jonas's own understanding of his deafness? And how did it change his relationship with his grandparents?
I think through Beethoven and through the discipline it required for him to learn this piece, which was really a reach for him, his relationship to his grandparents got much closer and deeper. And I think the central component of that was that his grandparents reminded him that he doesn't always have to listen to what he's playing. He can feel what he's playing. And my father often takes his implant off, or just switches it off, rather. And we call that in the film a superpower. The superpower is not this biomedical device that allows him to hear. It's the choice they have to turn it off. That's the superpower. And Jonas, as he's struggling at the sound of his own mistakes, he realizes that he can just switch it off and remember the song and play the song. And he started playing the first movement to me a number of times without his implant. But the first time he did, he played the whole thing without his implants. This is after he was in a really bad mood and he threw them on the floor. And he said, he finished and he played the whole thing and he said, "How did it sound?" And I'm, of course, behind the camera that night. It's 10 p.m. And I could barely get out the word beautiful because I was crying. That was a really hard moment for me, but a beautiful one.
Irene Taylor Brodsky is a documentary filmmaker. Her new movie is called Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. Irene, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
The documentary Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements is in theaters now. Coming up on The Frame, did you ever think your residence might need a house tuner? The new film, The Sound of Silence, is a low-budget art house indie. But when it came to mixing the sound of the movie, Dolby, the audio company, stepped in with its Atmos technology. That allows the audience to feel like they're experiencing the sound in 3D. It's a method usually reserved for big-budget blockbusters. The Sound of Silence director Michael Tiberski explained why audio was so important to the film and its main character.
Peter Lucian is something we call a house tuner. He goes into individuals' home, in this case his clients in New York City, to fine-tune the sonic landscape of their living spaces. People hire him for, you know, anxiety, emotional issues that they might be dealing with.
Your problem is your heating unit. When paired with the low tones produced by your kitchen appliances, the note emitted from your radiator is contributing to your anxiety.
He works not too dissimilarly to like a piano tuner, where he has a collection of tuning forks and a meter to make sure that our sonic surroundings are balanced. I think whether or not, you know, we're aware of it or not, everybody has a relationship with sound. And I really thought that this was a character who has a heightened hearing and has a unique kind of sonic perspective on the city, that he's a great conduit to tell a story about sound and to kind of bring things into the public dialogue that we're not always talking about and not always aware of. And, you know, whether we realize it or not, we are subconsciously, I believe, I subscribe to the fact that we're affected by the noises around us.
25, 30, 35, 40.
We use this archival footage from 1929. It was this group that was set up by the Department of Health in New York City. They were called Noise Abatement Commission. And these were gentlemen who went around with, you know, in this case, vintage microphones and recording equipment to record the din of the city. And they determined that the loudest areas in New York City in 1929 were Times Square and an area that was formerly named Radio Row in Lower Manhattan. And they produced a lot of data. The decibel was a new form of measurement at the time.
41, 42. Parkinson, make it 42. The noise in Times Square deprives us of 42% of our hearing.
It was really intriguing and interesting to know how much this is affecting our health on a noise level, but they didn't have any solution to it. So I like to think that, you know, close to 100 years later, a character like Peter could exist who is, thinking about sound scientifically.
So I learned by dissection how a piece of music works, what are its parts. You know, Bach, the composer Bach, his ability to trick our ears into believing that we're hearing multiple instruments from a single violin, or Stravinsky and his dissonance designed to alienate an audience, or Beethoven, his use of suspense and delayed gratification. But all of these composers were using neurological techniques that scientists hadn't even defined yet.
Normally, when you introduce a character in a screenplay, there's certain kind of protocol and rules, format that you follow, where you put a new character in all capitals, in all caps. So we treated sound the same way from the script phase. We wanted to call attention to that and make it this kind of, you know, invisible character that isn't necessarily tangible, but was very much going to be present in the film. One motif that kind of runs through the film is that Peter's character uses these noise-canceling earbuds in the film, but they're custom-made. You know, he's a fabricator of sorts, so everything that he uses is his own modification. And it was a certain kind of whooshing effect that would happen whenever Peter would insert or remove these earbuds, and suddenly the wash of New York City, the cacophony of sounds that are around you in New York at all the time, would kind of rush back into the soundtrack. And then once I got closer to production and Peter Sarsgaard came on board, one of the first things I did with him was actually made a radio edit of the movie. Him and I sat down and very much like this recorded the script, him and I, with microphones in a room, just so I could listen to the script and start hearing it. And then once we got to set, you know, I was experimenting with some of the music I was playing with that kind of audio edit of the movie. I love the theremin. I discovered for myself this album called The Lost Theremin Recordings of Clara Rockmore, who was probably the only virtuoso of the instrument, which usually gets associated with, B science fiction movies and suspense. But there's something so lovely and beautiful about the sound that it creates, and specifically the way she plays it, that I knew kind of fit into this world of this, you know, somewhat odd outsider scientist that just literally, as the theremin is played on the air, it kind of just always felt like it was part of the ether of the movie to me. I've lived in New York for just over a decade now, and I think, in a way, everybody's looking for answers. I think a lot of us, you know, need help, and There's so many different ways to, you know, go about seeking prescriptions to our ailments, especially in modern day New York City. I love the idea of a sound therapist. It didn't seem so far from reality that it could exist.
The Sound of Silence is in select theaters in L.A. and New York now. And that's it for the week. The Frame is produced by Darby Maloney, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Robert Garova, with help this week from Emily Henderson and Itzi Quintanilla. Our news clerk is Andrea Gutierrez, and our intern is Paul Ratliff. Valentina Rivera is the show's engineer. The opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. Make sure to tune in for the Frame Emmy special. It airs tonight at 7, Saturday at 2, and Sunday at noon. We're back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.